My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead in another full house. We're doing really well this week. Couple housekeeping things. Gary suggested several readings, and I've copied most of them off, Gary, and I'm just going to have them in the library, but I'm just going to put them right here. And if people want to take the time to read those, they're also online, so when you go home, you can check that out. But not now. I want to make that clear. So, but they're here for your use. On Holden Village, under education. And then check this week and check Gary Mason. So they're there, but they're for you. So again, it's my pleasure to introduce Gary Mason all the way from Northern Ireland, correct?
Correct.
So we are so pleased to have him here for almost 3 weeks. So it is our pleasure. Gary is a peacemaker. I think that's the word I'm going to use.
Okay, that's fine. Sounds okay. Yes.
Okay, all right. Methodist clergy person, yeah. And has been working with Rethinking Conflict for many years. So today he is going to talk about the role of reconciliation, memory, and theology in shaping public safety. We're thrilled he's here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Sharon, thank you for that introduction. What I'd like to do initially is maybe just kind of contextualize my life just a little so that you don't feel I'm speaking into a vacuum on quite a heavy title, and also just to tell you a little bit about my ministry. I often tell a true story of three young boys growing up in that very sectarian cockpit in Northern Ireland in the kind of 60s and 70s. They were just ordinary kids. I mean, they could have been born in Oregon or Washington State or Minnesota. Two of those kids went to Sunday school together. Another two of those kids went to what we call primary school together from age 4 to age 11. One of those kids is now dead. He got involved in terrorism, was shot in the back during a feud and died. The second boy ended up serving 18 years of a life sentence. He literally slit someone ear to ear, dumped their body in a back alley. And I'm the third boy that ends up a Methodist pastor. I tell that story to kind of contextualize my life, but also to try to give you some insight into why do people make violent choices to pursue political goals. Because I'm being very perfectly honest, I also could have made that choice very, very easily as a young boy. I often tell the sort of humorous story. I remember one night as a kind of 16-year-old kid standing at the bottom of this iron-wrought staircase and watching a number of my friends go up to join a Protestant paramilitary organization or terrorist organization or freedom fighters, depending on your context and where you're looking at that. And they went up and they took the Bible in one hand and the gun in the other. You always need a bit of kind of unhealthy religion to justify your nationalistic identity. And I didn't go up that kind of iron-wrought staircase to become a freedom fighter or a paramilitary or a terrorist. I remember kind of telling this story in an American church and someone kind of asking me the question, well, Gary, why did you not go up the staircase? And I says, well, honestly, it was probably something to do with lust. I had a date that night with a girl, and I said, teenage hormones were in overdrive, and I thought the date was more important than becoming a terrorist. I mean, that's a true story. You know, I remember sharing it with another person who grew up in a different tradition. I was very much shaped by that British Protestant Unionist Loyalist tradition. And he also said, you know, I remember one night also as a kid going to a certain house to join the IRA. And he said, I went to the wrong house. And by the time the next morning came, I said, it's probably a bad idea. That's not justifying terrorism, but it's trying to give us some understanding. Why do people make these choices? So I spent literally 3 decades of my life, never more than 100 meters from what we call peace lines. It's always typical Irish understatement. The official governmental title is interfaces, which are massive Berlin-type walls that separate Catholics and Protestants, particularly in Belfast. A statistic most American audiences don't know is we have built more peace lines since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. So most people globally look on the Irish context and assume it is a done deal. We still have an incredibly long way to go. Two projects I was involved in, I was ordained actually in June 1987, so literally just a matter of weeks ago, I kind of celebrated my 30th year anniversary of ordination. But from 92 to 99, I spearheaded a project called Forspring. Myself and a Catholic Dominican sister, who had spent 25 years in South Africa in the struggle against apartheid, tried to put together, literally on a peace line, a kind of ecumenical community trying to live out in the midst of the pain what relationships should look like, from sort of 92 to 99. They were very messy days, and I tell the story often. In October 1993 at 1:30, I got a phone call. A bomb had gone off pretty near my church on the Shankill. 9 people died in that. I lost 2 friends in that bombing. One, a young woman, 28 years of age, called Sharon McBride. I had co-officiated at her wedding to Alan a few years earlier. And I remember reaching the hospital, Alan coming out, putting his arms around me and saying, "Gary, she's gone, she's gone." Later that evening, I was at the bedside of a 38-year-old woman called Wilma McKee, who on the Friday, at 38 years of age, got the all clear for cancer, went out the next day to do some shopping, was caught up in the bomb, very severe head injuries, and I was at her bedside at 20 to 9. I can still see her with those serious wounds, talking to the neurologist, and I'm saying, 6 hours, she'll be dead. And I remember going outside into that hospital corridor, and her mom, her dad, her 14-year-old, her 12-year-old son, her husband were there. And I tell you, I can still close my eyes today, in July 017, I can tell you the exact color of the walls in that hospital. I can tell you the color of the clerical collar I had on that day. I can tell you the color of the suit I had on that day. I couldn't tell you what shirt I had on yesterday. So I would say people like me, and I know Nadia was alluding the other night about sort of vulnerability and transparency, probably like a number of people in our context, I probably have some form of secondary trauma, just from living through 30 years of a kind of civil war. I've negotiated 3 sort of terrorist feuds during that period of time as well, but in the last Saturday in June 2009, the Ulster Volunteer Force, which were the most lethal Protestant paramilitary or terrorist grouping, actually did their weapons decommissioning statement from my church building. They were the only terrorist grouping to do that. It was a very strange kind of day in many ways. The world's media were there, sort of CNN, BBC, ITV, to witness this statement. And normally when terrorist groupings, as you and I know, make statements, invariably, you know the normal drill. It's behind a table, their faces are covered, and there's always some nationalistic symbolism, be it flags or emblems, in the background. It was quite strange and a humorous day in a strange way because the statement was read from the church lectern in the fellowship hall, the lectern that I would preach my sermon from the next day. And fellowship halls, as you and I know at times, can be a little bit drab and dismal, so we kind of trail the flowers in from the sanctuary to sort of brighten it up a little bit for the world's media. But the stander on that day, and I've written about this in a book, a journalist friend of mine wrote in a chapter, it really was visions there of swords being beaten into plowshares. That a person who come up in a grey suit and a white shirt, no black clothing, no masks, and read out that statement that their weapons had been decommissioned after a 30-year terrorist campaign. So just a few years ago, I spearheaded a project called Skenos, along with a number of other folk, and It was a $30 million post-conflict urban village, shared space, trying to show people that 30 years after a bloody sectarian war, how do you painfully learn to share space together? How do you have those difficult, uncomfortable conversations, which I'm going to suggest that America also needs to have at the moment as well, but we'll spill around to that gradually. But increasingly over the last 5 or 6 years, I was being asked to do more work in the States and more work in the Middle East between the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In the last 5 years, I've hosted 300 Israelis and Palestinians in Belfast and also in Dublin, trying to bring in the extremes. I think sometimes in peace building, some organizations, and I'm not knocking this, okay, but I'm really not into sort of holding hands with priests and kind of kissing nuns and nice, warm, ecumenical services. We need to deal with those people who believe passionately that violence is the only way to resolve difference. So we do host people from Likud, who are on the right of Israeli society. And we don't put them in a room with a bunch of liberals. We put them in a room with right-wingers in our context who think like them politically, theologically, and psychologically. But the difference is the right-wingers on my side have done a deal with their enemies. So you have people in a room comparing life experience, comparing like with like. We also host joint groups of Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, 6 or 7 weeks ago, my wife Joyce, who's tucked in here along with me, hosted a project that we call Jerusalem and Belfast, sharing space in divided cities, where civic leaders from Jerusalem, both Palestinian and Israeli, grappled with the pain of trying to share space in an increasingly contested city. I mean, the last headline I saw before walking down the hill here with Joyce was more violence on the Dome of the Rock and Temple Mount. As you know, there was a very serious incident there last week. And so the city of Jerusalem at the moment is very tense and very difficult in relation to what way that is going to spill out. So let me try to move into that paper. That's just giving you a little bit of context. So really now I spent my life between the United States, the Middle East, and Ireland. I think it's really important that I do spend time at home. I was just saying to Peg and Chuck the other night, I still need a context to my life. I still need to work on my own peace process. I still need to work, as Isaiah says, with the flesh of my flesh, what shaped me as a human being. I don't want to be some kind of transient lecturer or speaker without some context that gives me authenticity to speak into your context or into the Middle East. And so we still spend 6 or 7 months a year just working through the painful legacy of the Irish conflict. A South African professor said these words. He said, "Reconciliation is no cheap matter. It does not come about by simply papering over deep-seated differences. Reconciliation presupposes confrontation. Without that, we do not get reconciliation, but merely a temporary glossing over of difference." He suggests the running sores of society cannot be healed with the use of a band-aid. Reconciliation presupposes an operation, a cutting to the very bone without anesthetic. The infection is not just on the surface. The abscess of hatred, mistrust, and fear between black and white, nation and nation, rich and poor, has to be slashed open. Northern Ireland is a very, very small place. You can drive 2 hours north, south, east, and west. Population now of 1.7 million, during the conflict 1.5 million. And in that very small space, we had, in a 30-year civil war, 47,000 injuries, 36,000 shootings, 22,000 armed robberies, over 30,000 people went through our penal system, over 16,000 bombings, over 2,000 arson attacks, and almost 4,000 deaths. Let me extrapolate those figures to the United States. That would have been 800,000 dead in your context and 6.4 million political prisoners. So you can imagine how we are still very much a very scarred nation. A lady and her husband, I think, here were mentioning they were in Derry a couple of years ago, and they said, you know, Gary, you felt there's still like a cloud over the city, and you're right. There are many clouds, many stories, a legacy of pain. We're talking here about a conflict going back 800 years with the kind of almost difficult bit beginning in the kind of 16th, 17th century. So the weight of history, the weight of memory is heavy on our shoulders. But let me kind of just tease out initially what I'm calling religious sectarianism. And looking at its kind of historical and theological origins. Let me also say, if any person wants to stop me, clarify this, by all means do so. I'll probably speak around sort of 40, 45 minutes. We need to finish at 12:30, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. But if you want to stop me or make a comment, just do that. I'm not asking you to listen to me in this monotone for the next 40 minutes, so feel free to break into this if you want. So three strap lines there. One, true church, outside of which there is no salvation. Secondly, looking at this whole concept of error has no right and providence. I mean, the doctrine of one true church, I guess most of us in this room are reasonably familiar with. Our church is the only true church, and if you're outside our church, your chances of salvation are much diminished at best. And in the 16th and 17th century, that was a very potent mix in European and in Irish society. Interestingly, there, the doctrine that error has no right is much less well known. Developed by the early church father, St. Augustine, and it was really developed to justify the use of state coercion to suppress his heretical opponents. Because they were simply radically in error, they have no right to express or hold their beliefs. So ever since, as we know, even a cursory glance at Christian history, that doctrine has been used behind every form of coercion for religious purposes. So penal laws, inquisitions, forced conversions, and all those similar ugly stains on Christian history. Providence, reasonably simple doctrine. We simply mean God is at work in the world, and the faithful Christian observer can discern the signs of the times. Let me play about with these doctrines for a minute. Let me combine one true church with error has no right. So one true church is a truth claim, okay? And like every truth claim, as we all know in this room, it carries the danger of arrogance and also imposition. But they're only dangers, they're not necessarily outcome. Everything depends on how the truth claim is made. But if you link one true church with error has no right, the chances are your truth claim will be made disastrously. Because if your church is the only true church and error has no right, it is your duty to see that error is suppressed by whatever means necessary. So tolerance isn't a virtue. Tolerance actually becomes a deadly vice. So let's combine one true church with providence. Providence, God is at work in the world. But if you combine it with the one true church, it's easily reduced to the concept of God is on our side. So literally, I mean, yards from the Skenos building that I spearhead, we have this massive paramilitary wall mural still there, and the slogan above it, which was formed in 1912 by the old Ulster Volunteer Force, was For God and Ulster. But within the Republican Catholic context, there were wall paintings in West Belfast, a very strong Republican Catholic enclave of the Virgin Mary with the island of Ireland shaped as her hair. So that toxic mix of religion and national identity saying clearly and concisely, God is on my side. And it's interesting, you know, 17th century France makes a useful comparison to Ireland, because French Protestants, okay, in a dominated Catholic state, suffered a similar set of disabilities to Catholics in a dominated Protestant state. In fact, the two rival regimes in the 17th century actually kept an eye on one another to justify their use of penal laws. So let me just kind of spill on a little. The power of memory. 1641, as a little boy, I was taken faithfully to watch our British Protestant Unionist Loyalist parades. We're obsessed with parading in Ireland, absolutely obsessed. In Northern Ireland, we have 4,500 parades every single year. So that's in a population of 1.7 million. If you're bored some evening, look up the website of the Parades Commission and you will see on one single day, you could have 30 parades across that small piece of land, marking out our territory. But I remember as a little boy, it's kind of 6 years of age, taken faithfully to watch the Orange Order, a distinctly Protestant-only organization, and seeing all those incredibly colorful banners, and seeing one from 1641, a picture of Protestants in a river, up to their necks in water, about to be drowned by the Catholics. And I've often said to myself, psychologically, as a six-year-old kid, I didn't understand that. But I did know this. Catholics drowned Protestants. But on the other side, the Catholic kid was seeing images of the Lord Protector, the Puritan Oliver Cromwell, and his troops as they swept through Drogheda, ramming swords and spears through the chests of Catholics. And I guess his image as a six-year-old kid was exactly the same. Protestants kill Catholics. And those stories of the kind of 16th and 17th century have shaped our identity in Ireland for so many years. A couple of years ago, I was speaking at a conference at York St. John University, and a young woman in her early 30s, a Japanese professor, said this. She said, an incomprehensible act becomes comprehensible when told in conjunction with religion. Let me just say that again. An incomprehensible act becomes comprehensible when told in conjunction with religion. So that old sort of for God and Ulster, for God and Ireland, has spilled into that context of mine in so many ways. So if you ask me today, Gary, where do the roots of sort of 21st century sectarianism lie? Ireland is frozen in the pre-modern. But let me ask you a question. Where do the current roots of your division, okay, your racism, your very divided nation lie? Okay, I want to suggest, and we'll open this up for debate, that they lie in the past. Because I think there are a number of legacy issues that the United States has not dealt with, and I'll tease that out in a few minutes.
Would you repeat that, please?
Okay. I did this on the top of my head, so it's not my notes, okay? So I'm suggesting, and I'll come on to this shortly, that some of the issues in the United States, as I think was seen during some of your presidential nomination debates, which I was here for 2 months last year watching those, I don't think those were shaped by the 21st century. I think they were shaped psychologically and politically about a past that many people in the United States cannot agree on. Okay? So I'll expand that theory, okay, in a few moments. But let me just kind of flip up a few bits and pieces about what I'm calling sort of toxic religion. Okay, Christian anti-Semitism, I'm not going to do a long blurb on that, but let me read from the second chapter of Mein Kampf, which, as you all know, Adolf Hitler wrote. And in the second chapter he says this, "Today, I believe, I am acting in accordance with the will of God Almighty. Now, Hitler denominationally was Catholic, but was not a regular mass goer, as all of us in this room know. I am acting in accordance with the will of the Almighty Creator by defending myself against the Jews. And someone commenting on that, a scholar called Saul Friedlander, says that we need to think about something called redemptive anti-Semitism. And literally it goes like this. The Holocaust, or the Shoah, was built on centuries of Christian anti-Semitism. What you and I would call religious anti-Semitism, Hitler very cleverly takes and makes racial anti-Semitism. In my context, if you were to say to me today, Gary, was your 30-year civil war a religious war? I would say categorically no. It was more about nationalism, land, and identity. But I would suggest strongly that what I call the toxic religious sectarian roots created the fertile soil, okay, for people to be able to kill each other in the name of God. So as a close friend of mine, who Chuck and Peg know, called Jim Wilson, who is a leading loyalist terrorist, said, you know, Gary, it was much easier to kill Catholics when you were taught they were shit in Sunday school. Another friend of mine, who ended up murdering two Catholics, heard a speech by a right-wing Protestant fundamentalist preacher, and he said to me, you know, Gary, it lit a fire within me. And I says, well, Billy, it most certainly was not the fire of the Holy Spirit. Go.
When you said it was easier to kill Catholics when they were what?
When you were taught they were shit in Sunday school.
Oh.
So theologically, they were the other.
Less than.
They were less than.
Okay.
Their theology was not ours. But in that context as well, I mean, to look at Catholicism. Let's be honest, pre-1965, all of us in this room were not classed as separated brethren. We were classed as heretics. And I don't need to remind you the story of the church in relation to dealing with heretics. So that kind of very toxic theology has this ability to spill into national, and I touch on the Balkans and a few other bits and pieces later on. So that sort of fusing of religion and using it in a very toxic manner is incredible. Let me give you a couple more quotations. Thomas Idenopoulos says, it is impossible for me to reflect on the Holocaust without remembering centuries of Christian theological antagonism towards Judaism. And he uses this phrase, and it'd be interesting just to hear this phrase when we open up our discussion. So I want you to take this phrase and contextualize it in your US situation. He quotes the French historian Jules Isaac, and he talks about the teaching of contempt. Okay? So maybe that's a good phrase.
Yeah.
The teaching of contempt. So within your American context, you tell me, do you theologically have a teaching of contempt? And if you do, what are possible end results? We'll play about with that as we go along. But Raoul Hilberg said this. The missionaries of Christianity had said, in effect, you have no right to live among us as Jews. Don't assume, I mean, a few weeks ago I was leading a tour on the Holocaust and anti-Semitism in Poland and was in the Warsaw Ghetto. But don't assume the Nazis were the original ghetto creators. It was the church. Okay. It's a church, let's be honest. The church created the ghettos, the separation. And so Raoul Hilberg there says quite clearly, we as Christians said you have no right to live among us as Jews. He says the secular rulers who followed said you have no rights, okay, to live among us as Jews. And the Nazis finally decreed you have no right to live.
Yeah.
But the process began, okay, with the attempt to drive Jews into Christianity. I mean, a scholar there, Gabriel Wilinski, if you want to do some reasonably heavy reading over the next couple of months, has written this book entitled 6 Million Crucifixions. It's a very evocative title. And I've read it twice. It's very difficult to disagree with the toxic roots that the church led in relation to the Holocaust. The chief rabbi of the British Commonwealth, Jonathan Sacks, and so if you want to read a brilliant book, it would be in the top 10 that I've ever read. It's called Not in My Name. It talks about violence in the name of God. It is brilliant. He deals with the Torah in a way that no Jewish scholar or Christian scholar has done. He deals with all this kind of sibling rivalry within the Torah. It's an absolute masterpiece. But Jonathan Sacks said this. He said in one point, and it is a substantial one, the critics of religion are right. Religion has done harm. It has led to crusades, jihads, inquisitions, pogroms. It has shed the blood of human sacrifice in the name of high ideals. People have hated in the name of the God of love. Practiced cruelty in the name of the God of compassion. Waged war in the name of the God of peace and killed in the name of the God of life. And Sacks says those are undeniable facts and they are terrifying. However, the great believers have always known this. Pascal said, and excuse my language, which is not politically correct, it's from another generation, but he said men never, and primarily it is men that are the most violent, and we can talk about that in peace processes because women invariably are not at the table in peace negotiations. We'll play about with that a little bit later on. But Pascal says men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from a religious conviction. Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travels, probably most of us read that as kids, but Jonathan Swift was also the dean of Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin. Swift said this, "We have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough religion to make us love one another." And C.S. Lewis, who I always remind American audiences, and had a conversation today around that, they're talking about Narnia. C.S. Lewis was born in Belfast. At one stage he talked exactly like me, but eventually developed that more English accent when he went to be a professor of medieval and Renaissance literature at Cambridge University. But C.S. Lewis said this, "I think we must fully face the fact that when Christianity does not make a man very much better, invariably it makes them very much worse." And Sacks commenting on that says that not happens not because religion is religion, but because human beings are human beings, they're not angels, and they're certainly not God. And then he comes out with this incredibly profound analysis. He says, religion has power. It bonds people as a group. It moves people to act. It changes lives. And then he says, whatever has power can be used, misused, and abused. Religion is like fire. It warms, but it also burns. And we are guardians of that flame. So religion definitely has power. I mean, why in God's name have 450 people traveled this journey up to here? Like, it's because of the power of faith and religion. But because it's such a powerful force, it can be used, misused, and abused. But Sacks sums that up well, where he says it's like fire, but it warms, but it also burns. But the crucial punch is there, we are the guardians of that flame. So how do we as religious leaders, as religious people, as people of faith, guard that flame? Let me look at racism and sectarianism, okay? So racism and sectarianism are twin evils running through the Christian church. I will ask the question in the United States context. I think most churches, I think, by and large, do what I call pastorally Pretty well, okay. We're pretty good at funerals and weddings and baptisms and counseling. Prophetically, you answer this, not me. It's not up to me to critique your context. How is the American church prophetically? Okay. Are there any Amoses standing on the sidelines of society critiquing the culture of the United States in the same way as Amos stood on the sidelines of society and critiqued Israeli culture of another generation? I remember a couple of years ago I saw this article by a professor in Union Theological Seminary in Upper West Side in New York City, and he just had this one strap line where he said, "No one in the United States wants to deal with a legacy of slavery." So I sort of pulled the sentence out and said, there's a really interesting S word, i.e. slavery. I says, let me tell you about my S word. It's not slavery, it's sectarianism. And I said, and as a kid, growing up in that sectarian cockpit of Northern Ireland, no one had the courage to deal with sectarianism. I get a little bit tired of, you know, ministers of another generation, and they're not all in this category. But, you know, telling me, you know, Gary, in the 50s and in the 60s, our churches were filled, you know, almost telling me the story in the kind of 90s and 2000 onwards, lamenting the fact that many of our churches are now empty. As if because our churches were full in the 50s and 60s, that was something incredibly wonderful. So I do have to say then prophetically, well, your gift as a church to my generation was a bloody civil war. Why? Because you hadn't the courage to deal with sectarianism. And too many pastors end up simply chaplains to their own tribes without having that prophetic courage to engage with what is happening in society in a wider context. So no one in the United States wants to talk about the legacy of slavery. I said, well, let me tell you about my S word, as I said. No one dealt with that. We end up like with a 30-year civil war, which we're going to carry the legacy for another 50-plus years, I imagine, at least. I said, I'm not suggesting that American society is moving towards a civil war, but I am suggesting that unless you deal with this legacy, your cities will become more violent and more segregated. And I wrote that like 4 or 5 years ago, and I don't class myself as a prophet, but I've watched American society closely. I mean, this is like my 70th visit or something to the place. And I've watched the segregation and the separation. And I said, and my concern is, when our conflict broke out, we didn't have a lot of weaponry. You know, we had to go to the States, naturally, to get guns. We had to go to South Africa, Middle East, Colonel Gaddafi, and Eastern Europe. My concern would be, if it goes wrong here, this place is awash with weaponry. So I'm just asking the question, in your context, what is the role of the church in that? John?
Well, there were some people, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King, and James Baldwin talked about slavery and the effects.
Yeah.
The 13th Amendment, they did talk about it, but I guess white people weren't listening.
Yeah. And again, you know, in our open conversation, we'll ask why. So let me ask you another question. And don't put your hand up for this, okay? How many of your churches have sent your youth on summer mission trips, don't put your hand up, to Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, to paint a church hall? Okay. Now, my friend Bob Lupton, whom I'll see in a few weeks' time in Atlanta, Georgia, Bob has done a lot of research around this. He probably read his book, Toxic Charity, and he says, most of those kids that stand up and say, this changed my life for Jesus, he says, most of them are lying, because it hasn't. And he asked the question, does a village hall in Haiti really need painted 3 years in a row? Yeah. Delta Airlines love mission trips. I mean, quietly, Delta Airlines officials have said to Bob, if it wasn't for some of these mission trips, you would screw our profits into the ground. So question, why not put that money into some community organizing in Haiti? Or even better, let me ask you another question, no hands. How many of your churches do mission trips to Birmingham, Alabama, to Selma, to Atlanta, Georgia, to look at the roots of racism? Don't answer. And if not, all I'm simply asking is, why not? So, I think as Jim Wallace there said quite clearly a while ago, America, we have a problem. Because racism and sectarianism emanate from a politics of difference. Let me try to tease this out here for a moment in section D. What do they rely on? What did my sectarian culture rely on? What does a racism culture rely on? Relies in this. The ideology of superiority. Okay. Protestants, Catholics, Catholics, Protestants. Greater entitlement of one group over another. So they operate on kind of similar baselines, upwards through this kind of pyramid of hatred, prejudice attitudes, acts of prejudice, discrimination, harassment, violence. So in terms of lived experience, racism and sectarianism are very much alike. And it's also argued in our context that the troubles, as we typical Irish understatement call them, have actually desensitized individuals and communities to violence, to a kind of permissive environment in which violence is seen as the best means to achieve political and social objectives. So let me just highlight an article here. I sent it to Chuck. There's been a book there published called, this will, it's evocative, okay. It's called Hitler's American Model. Okay. Published by a guy called James Whitman, okay. He said this: Nazi lawyers regarded America, not without reason, as the innovative world leader in the creation of racist law.
Could you read that one more time?
Yeah. Nazi lawyers regarded America, not without reason, as the innovative world leader in the creation of racist law. I'm going to give you a number of quotations. So if you want this, just at my email, I'll whip up on a sheet there. I can send it to you or send it to Chuck and stick it, which I did this morning, and you can put it in the library. But let me just give you a couple of quotations. In the 1930s, in the American South, and Nazi Germany were the world's most straightforwardly racist regimes, proud of the way they had deprived blacks and Jews, respectively, of their civil rights. He says historians have downplayed the connection between Nazi race law and America because America was mainly interested in denying full citizenship rights to blacks rather than Jews. But Whitman suggests that in the mid-1930s, Nazi politicians turned again and again to the United States in the way they deprived African Americans of the right to vote and to marry whites. They were fascinated by the way the United States had turned millions of people into second-class citizens. And strange as it may seem to us, the Nazis saw America as a beacon for the white race. Early 20th century, he suggests, America was the global leader in race law. Hitler praised American immigration restrictions in Mein Kampf. So it's documented there. So the Fuhrer praised these American restrictions. In the area of racial restrictions in marriage, America stood alone as a pioneer. And so he goes on and on But I'll get the article and Chuck there can put it in the library. Let me just take 10 minutes on another bit and then we'll open it up to discussion. So this whole concept of the power of memory. In the Jewish tradition, why is this night different than any other night? Okay. In our tradition, this do in remembrance of me. So as people of faith, we're people of memory. I mean, memory is such a crucial component. United Nations Handbook on Reconciliation suggests that some countries choose to ignore the past completely. But memory is also a two-edged sword. It can play a crucial role in making reconciliation achievable, but also has the ability to hinder reconciliation processes. So one scholar writes, too great a concern with remembering the past can mean that the divisions and conflicts of old never die. The wound is never healed. So in such circumstances, and I know this every day in my life, the past continues to dominate the present, and hence to some degree determines the future. So memory can be incredibly selective, but worse, it can be manipulated and abused. So literally across from the Skenos building where Joyce and I would host seminars when we have groups in from overseas, there is this wall mural. Chuck and Peg will know it. And it's a number of headlines of atrocities Republicanism, Catholicism has done against my community. Never what we did to them. And above it is this inscription, the price of peace is eternal vigilance. Now, initially, a kind of cursory glance at that sort of title, it said, that's quite a nice little phrase. The price of peace, sort of nearly spiritual, the price of peace is eternal vigilance. Bluntly, what does it really mean? Always keep an eye on those bastards on the other side because you will never be able to trust them. That's what it really means.
Make sure you have a bigger gun.
Yeah. You know, so that's what it really means. But it's a nice phrase. Hmm. But it means always watch the other. The movie, Joyce, what was the one? History of a Nation. What was the one recently? Birth of a Nation. Who's seen that? Okay, you remember the white guy standing in his field when things were changing, and he was concerned that blacks were going to get equal rights. His phrase, we don't want those kind down here. Always keep an eye on the other person. You simply cannot trust the other. So memory can be really, really manipulated. I mean, World War II France, classic example. And you know how the German occupation divides it into resistors and collaborators? After the war, the French government superbly had this brilliant, well-planned discourse and academic research that minimized the importance of collaboration and maximized the importance of the resistance. So what they really did was invent a glorious past. And it was only in the 1960s that the cracks began to appear, and the old divisions arose to challenge it. Have you seen the movie Sir Is Key? Has anyone seen that movie? Yeah. So you know the story. I think it's an American journalist is doing some research in Marais, in the old Jewish quarter in Paris, and discovers, well, it actually wasn't the Nazis rounded up the Jews. It was the French police.
Can you name the movie again,
sir? Sir Is Key. Sir Is Key, as in opening the door. Yeah, Sir Is Key. Yeah, Sir Is Key. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a great film. So it is very, very well put together. I mean, another movie in that context as well was Aftermath. And it's spilled out of Jan Gross's book, Neighbors. And the movie created an uproar in Poland because in a certain village in Poland, it was always assumed the Nazis murdered all the Jews. No. It was the Polish Catholics who rose up and murdered all their neighbors and blamed it on the Nazis. And many Polish nationalists went crazy because the self-image of the Poles in this context being the victims was untrue. Because they were accustomed to seeing themselves as victims during World War II rather than in this occasion to being the victimizers. Again, in your context, the movie 12 Years a Slave. Why did it not provoke a bigger national conversation around the history of racism? I'll tell you. Final story, and then we'll open it up for discussion. We all have what sort of sociologists or historians call interpretive keys. How we interpret life and history. Okay, so 1389, the Serbs fought against the emergent Ottoman Empire and lost the Battle of Kosovo. But that was the interpretive key for how the Serbs understood themselves. And one Yugoslav said, "Take away the Battle of Kosovo and you take away the soul of the Serb nation. We have fought to defend the Christian values of Europe, but Christian Europe, and particularly the Catholics, never appreciated the sacrifice the Serbs made." And so what happens? When President Milosevic spills in the 600th anniversary, that was used several years later to justify the murder of 10,000 Bosnian Muslims. Now, how do you connect, like, 1389, that people are living, dates are tattooed in my skull, you know, like 1641, 1690, 1798, 1801, 1912, 1916, 1921. I know my interpretive keys. I know the power of story. Two final stories. I lied. I have two more. Okay, and then we'll look for a discussion. Right? Okay. Okay, I'm in Atlanta 20 years ago with a friend. He's highly educated. He's an architect and his wife's a pharmacist. Okay? And he takes me to the cyclorama, which depicts Sherman's burning of Atlanta. It's a kind of 360 degrees where you sit in a seat and you sort of swivel around this brilliant piece of artwork and you see all the different stages. So as Michael and I are walking out into the outside car park, he turns to me and he says, "Gary, isn't it awful what those damn Yankees did to our city?" So I sort of, "How long ago was that, Michael?" He goes, "Oh, about 150 years. And you worry about us Irish and our obsession with dates." So the stories are still alive and well here. There's a psychological theory called kids who carry our pain. For any person here who's done any form of family therapy, you know what I mean. How us parents can pass our pain to our kids and they pass it down from generation to generation. It's so easy to do. I sort of taken that psychological theory and moved it into what you and I would call nationhood or community context. So how we tell our stories are incredibly important. So let me just finish with this illustration. Abraham Joshua, the Jewish theologian, said it was words, not machines, that created Auschwitz. Okay, let me say that again. It was words, not machines, that created Auschwitz. So let me illustrate this, okay? It's the late 80s. It's the Balkans. There's some form of integration, but there's also still a form of tension. And we're going to meet three families, Mr. and Mrs. Serb, Mr. and Mrs. Bosnian Croat, and Mr. and Mrs. Muslim, okay? So there's no role play. So Chuck and Peg, they will be Mr. and Mrs. Serb. You will be Mr. and Mrs. Croat, and you will be Mr. and Mrs. Bosnian Muslim. It's 9 o'clock at night, okay? The kids are sitting at their feet, almost ready for bed in their pajamas, and mom and dad are talking. So let's listen to Mr. and Mrs. Serb. Those cursed Catholic Croats. They allied themselves with the Nazis during the Second World War and this nonsense of the one true Catholic Church. We the Serbs, the Orthodox Serbs, we are the one true church. And as for those cursed Muslims, look at what they did to us Serbs under the Ottoman Empire. And so the kids hear the stories. They digest the story. They digest the interpretive historical pain. And I promise you this, they will pass it to their kids and to their grandkids. And so we pop into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Croatian Catholic. We, the Catholics, we are the one true church. After all, did Jesus not say to Peter, on this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it? It is us, not them. And those cursed Muslims. Look at what they did to us under the Ottoman Empire. The kids hear the story, they digest the story, they digest the pain. We pop into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Bosnian Muslim. Those cursed Christians with their inquisitions and their crusades and their crosses and their flags with crosses on them. As they sweep through Western Europe, Eastern Europe, they reach the holy city of Jerusalem. They attack us. They decapitate us and the Jews. And they put our heads around the ramparts of that city. You can't trust those Christians. And so we pass the pain from generation to generation. I remember as a little boy, my grandfather, whom I love, but who again grew up in that subterranean cockpit of Northern Ireland, taught me a little song. I still remember it as a man in my 50s. It goes like this. I'm not going to sing it. It goes, sprinkle, splatter, holy brown water. We'll scatter those papishes, every one. If that doesn't do, sure, we'll cut them in two, and we'll give them a touch of the orange and blue, which are Protestant colors. Now, can you imagine, like, as a six-year-old kid sitting, you know, I should have been reading Gulliver's Travels. But no, you need to listen to me. Those bloody Catholics. We'll scatter them. We'll cut them in two. We'll give them a touch of the orange and blue. So like Abraham Joshua, it's a profound quotation. It was words, not machines, that created Auschwitz. And that's why Jesus said, just in case you've forgotten what this disturbing first century rabbi said, you'll also be judged on your words as well as your actions. So I will stop there. Tomorrow I'm going to do a little bit more sort of theology, one or two clips, but with like, say, 20, 25 minutes for comments, critiques, questions, whatever. So it's over to you. So make comments. It doesn't, you know, there's lots of wisdom in this room. So, other people, you want to share a story or highlight this? Okay, this lady here.
I just had a question about what you said about we need to have prophetic legacy, was it?
Probably not, yeah, prophetic insight. That just that ability to actually, as I say, you know, it's a bit like this sort of all those P's in the church, isn't it? It's like, you know, like within the evangelical tradition, we've been very big on proclamation, the word, but poor in presence. So you're trying to balance proclamation of the word with presence in the city or with the person, and those other two pieces, sort of pastoral versus prophetic. So you're trying, was a church pretty good pastorally, but prophetically at times hasn't the courage. But I think in your context, and I said this to a number of church leaders because I'm doing some work with the Florida and Georgia conference, I think if you're ever going to grapple with your legacy, and this is no shock to you, there is absolutely no way either your politicians, Democrats, or Republicans will do this. It just ain't going to happen. It really isn't. What you need is a conglomeration of people of goodwill. I'm suggesting NGOs, churches, and academics, that you put together a coalition of the willing to deal with some of these issues. Politicians, I've often said, so it is. We'll try to bring some good politicians on board as well. But politicians, in our peace agreement, it was assumed, I'll not go into too much detail, but it was politicians assume that when peace agreements are signed, that societal healing automatically follows. So, like, nothing could be further from the truth. So we have this theory back home called the political peace process versus the social peace process. So people in this room should be people of social peace processes. Bedding down, dealing with legacy issues, forgiveness, acknowledgement, apology, citizenship, all those concepts. So you really need, the other analysis I use, let's assume I take cancer today. You know, I go to the hospital in Seattle. I will be under a multidisciplinary team. You know, I'll have five or six specialists dealing with me to ensure, hopefully, I get through this illness. But yet when we come to peacemaking so many times, we leave it in the hand of politicians, who by very nature are people of short-term vision. So that's why we need a multidisciplinary approach. We need academics, we need theologians, we need ethicists, we need philosophers, we need historians. So it's like people in this room are the people who heal society, not politicians. So, yeah, go ahead.
Is it Derry or Londonderry?
Well, it depends who you are. You know, I mean, Sharon introduced me there, Gary from Northern Ireland. It's a very British Protestant phrase. Republicans, Sinn Féin, IRA, they say the North. They wouldn't even use the word Northern Ireland. So we can't even agree on a flaming name of where we live. So we can't. Nor in the city, because it was Derry. Then when the English came, they put London in front of it. So the kind of humorous, you know, we still have this ability to laugh at ourselves. So it's often just L stroke Derry. So some people call it stroke city, you know, to kind of rip it off. So it's, but that you can't, you know. But the power of words again, you know that.
Yeah.
So go ahead, sir. Don, go ahead.
Just thinking when you say the power of memory, that currently in our current society, the power of fake news is equally important.
Yeah. And also I often say, you know, Joyce hates me doing this illustration because it embarrasses her, but people often ask me, oh, how do you know it's a Catholic or a Protestant? You know, how do you know who the person is? So I often, we sort of use this illustration. Joyce is very reserved and shy. So, but okay, let's assume, you know, it's the 1970s, 1980s. I see this nice girl on the disco floor. That dates me immediately. Kids do nightclubs now. They don't do discos. So, you know what age I am as soon as you say disco in a sense. So I see this nice girl and I say to her, do you want to get up to dance? But I'm wired. I want to know, is she Catholic or Protestant? Immediately, because my granny will kill me if you dare bring a Catholic to this house. Just in the same way, you know, not too many white people were doing interracial dating, were you, in the 50s and 60s? So, you know that kind of stuff. So I see this girl and I say, tell me, what's your name? And she says, my name's Joyce. And I go, oh, right. She had to say Elizabeth. I'd have gone, I'm in a winner. She's called after the Queen. She's a Protestant. I'm okay. Didn't work, okay. Or she had to say Bridget or Sinead or Bernadette, gone, Catholic. I'm out of here. So she says, Joyce. Okay, so I say, okay. Joyce, tell me, where do you live? Because 90% of us in Northern Ireland still live in segregated areas. But she's a rich little kid. She lives in the Malone Road, which is one of the few integrated areas. I'm not giving up. I say, okay, that's good. Yeah. One thing I know, she's rich, so this is looking pretty good, this relationship. I'm going to retire really early. This is looking good. So my third question I say to her is, hey, tell me, what school did you go to? Because 93% of us are still educated in segregated schools. But my luck's out again. She says, Gary, I went to Lagan College, which is one of the 7% of integrated Catholic and Protestant schools. But I don't give up. I say to her, Joyce, say the letter H. Protestants say H. Catholics say H. We say the very letter, even differently. So you have ways of finding out, because you're wired that way. So that's another hand there. It's this lady here.
Yeah, I found it interesting when you were saying, you know, the people in this room will be the one to form that group, which I love the idea of that.
Yeah.
And I would love to be part of something like that, but I'm also very aware that pretty much perhaps all of us in this room are white.
Yeah.
There's a real sensitivity these days for white people coming in to, we will solve this problem, you know, and so there's got to be a lot of connection with the black community about what can we do, let them take the, or, you know, I don't know, it's just...
Yeah.
That's a really difficult, sensitive part of how to figure out how to do it.
Do you know what fascinates me? I first priest in Atlanta in 1988, you know, as quite a young man, I sort of late 20s. And in the early 1990s, I put together this program called Journey and Understanding. It was really what we call uncomfortable conversations between Catholics and Protestants, which are really, really crucial. And I've often said the number of churches about it and sort of, you know, there hasn't been a great uptake. And here, it's so easy to translate this into your context. So here's what happens, okay? So it's an 8-week encounter, okay, really simple, okay? The first 4 weeks, Catholics and Protestants are on their own. In your case, blacks and whites are on their own. So in our context, we look at our troubling history and its interpretation, the role of bad religion in conflict, psychological trauma in conflict, and what does reconciliation really mean? So in those 4 weeks, Catholics, Protestants, blacks or whites, get an understanding, get a feeling, and then they come together for the final 4 weeks to really ask those difficult questions that we don't ask. And that's why I quoted that South African professor at the beginning. Churches are just, they're just too nice at times. But as I said the other night, they're also quite dishonest. Because we all know this stuff is bubbling below the surface. So how do we explode myths? How do we explode stereotypes? I did some of this work in South Africa in the early 1990s, and it was difficult, you know, very. You know, where whites were saying to blacks quite gravely, well, we've been brought up to believe you people are lazy, or you people are communists, or you're supporters of the ANC, and the blacks are saying, well, as far as we're concerned, some of us still believe one settler, one bullet. But those things need to be said. One settler, one bullet, so like, boom, get rid of those whites. So this, but if that's there, the difficulty is, and that's one of my critiques at time of the church. There was a time back home when we had a lot of clergy just thought, oh, if we, you know, just can get Catholics and Protestants in a little church service together, singing songs to Jesus, it's all going to be okay. That's trash. So it is. People need to have difficult, facilitated conversations. You need to get to know the other. I mean, I look at Israel and Palestine at the moment, and we were there in November, the month, I was there in January, and I said to both the Israelis and Palestinians, this place at the moment is simply a propaganda feast. Every time I go into Ramallah, I find out all what's wrong with the Israelis. Every time I go into Tel Aviv, I find out what's wrong with the Palestinians. And until they create some force to move this thing forward, we're going to end up with constant violence. And I think in your situation, people have to have the courage to bring about this joint alliance. Or you know what, see, in 50 years' time, when we're most of us are dead in this room, you're still going to be having this conversation. John?
So I was struck by the amount of history behind your conflict and Israel-Palestine. It's like hundreds of years for you, and for that one, 70, maybe 80 years.
But you've but you've hundreds of years here. You know, I mean, that's why racism and sectarianism. I think sometimes Americans think, you know, oh no, we don't use castles like you and all the rest of it. But you know, when did slavery start? Like this is like 16th, 17th century stuff. Yeah. So your legacy in that context. I mean, it's fascinating to me that Americans don't twig onto this here. You know, people, oh, this is only, but no, this didn't begin in the 60s. You know, when the civil rights movement began. You've been dealing with this junk since the 16th and 17th century. I mean, I know, like, I mean, slave ships were turned away from Belfast, one of the few things we got right, in a sense. But they docked in Liverpool. I mean, there's a slavery museum now in Liverpool. Mm. So this stuff, I mean, this is a 400-year legacy for America. And really, the most difficult period of our, like, we go back 800 years, John, but if you were to say what was the kind of mega moment, 16th, 17th century plantation, which was theological, were the Calvinists, will the God give us this land theology, come push the Catholics of the fertile land in the northern part of Ulster, but they don't stop there because they eventually come to the United States with the same theology of God gave us the land and moved the Native Americans off as well. So there's always that, you know, is that underpinning messy, toxic theology always playing about with these things as well? Okay, this lady and this gentleman.
I was reading a couple of articles that I saw on children being raised in secular humanist homes are kinder and more socially involved because it removes the whole God is for us religion. I mean, I'm assuming that's a big part of it. What is your experience with that? Do you see that where the church is not involved? Do you see more secular humanists getting involved on the grassroots level?
I mean, and I have no difficulty with those joint alliances. I suppose the one word I would say in relation to that is Stalin. You know, so like, you know, they come at this very much from a kind of communistic, atheistic perspective, and you end up with like tens of million dead. So I just think, I never think it's kind of either or, it's both and. You know, so for example, you know, when Joyce and I released Belfast Mission spearheading Skynos, like we had 100 staff, and the only people that had to be sort of believers or Christians were those who were working in the church. So we had 100 staff, 5 church staff, and 95 other staff working in sort of homelessness, employability. So the only prerequisite there was that they were comfortable enough with that Methodist social conscience, which any atheist could sign up to, in a sense. You know, so it was creating those alliances of people of goodwill, in that sense. And I think, I suppose I want to say, it's that if you grew up with that God is on our side mentality,
Yeah.
That's obviously, but for so many folk in this room, I'm guessing none of you are teaching your children that God is white, American, etc., etc., etc. If you grow up with that mentality, you're going to end up pretty askewed through time. Sorry.
Yeah, with the United States, you know, the difference I see in the United States is that we institutionalized slavery. We institutionalized in our founding document, not the Declaration of Independence, but the Constitution, that blacks were 3/5 of human beings. Yeah. And when you institutionalize it and put it in your founding document, and then you add the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. And if you don't think that had to do with slavery.
Beautiful mix there.
And I've got to have my gun to keep those lazy, whatever, coming from my door, coming to my door.
Could I ask a naive question? Is that still there in that founding document?
Well,
has
it
been rescinded?
It's been rescinded. In the sense of the Civil Rights Act, in the sense of the 13th Amendment is the one that rescinds it. But it's still... But it was there, and people know it. I think it's in Article 4 of our Constitution.
This lady here?
No, that's true, too.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that the real power in this country is wielded by the 1% or even the tenth of 1%, the uber-rich that control the big multinational corporations. And that power controls all the politics, and that they are just exploiting the underlying racism and classism for their own ends, to keep the country divided.
They stir the fear.
They keep the fear level up, so that they can just do what they want in the background and get richer off of everybody else's backs. So, I mean, that's my perception, and I'm open to hearing your response.
A couple of things maybe around that. When sort of early days, early Belfast mission, sort of 99, I was sent there, stationed there, to use our Methodist phraseology. And we put together this thing called the Inner East Forum. It was probably representing just about 30 groups in the inner city. And really the idea of that, I suppose, was to begin to hold politicians accountable. So let me just kind of tease this out a little, because it's a model any church or any organization in this room can use. If I go with sort of Gary Mason and say, oh, well, I like 150, 200 people attend my church and, you know, thousands come through our community projects every year. Politicians are going to go, nah, don't want to see him. But we put together this conglomeration of churches, community groups, and when we counted it up, we were representing between us about 40 to 50,000 people. Now, when we got in touch with the politician, the Inner East Forum would like to meet you. They wanted to listen. So that's why it's got to be an alliance of people. So there's no reason why any group in this room cannot put together some form of community forum that begin to hold. We're really bad, you know, at holding politicians accountable. We elect these people and we don't hold them accountable. And if they think there is a chance of them losing their seat at the next election, they're going to listen. But they're not going to listen to little Gary individually. But if you put together some meaningful alliance, they've got to begin to listen. So it's just, it's very simple. There's nothing brilliant about it. But it's using the power of community groups. Some are completely secular faith groups. It's putting an alliance together of goodwill to begin to change the inner city. And it's been done in America. I mean, my friend Bob Lupton there, I mean, Bob spent 40 years in the inner city. You know, I mean, I'm not a golfer, I never will be, but, you know, Bobby Jones was the sort of, like, Rory McIlroy or Tiger Woods of the 1930s. And, like, in the 1980s, the area Grant Park in Atlanta was a mess. I mean, people were being held up by drug dealers at the 18th hole, and the whole golf course fell into disrepair. And Bob Lupton, through a business person, Tom Cousins, who's a big sort of mega building magnate there in Atlanta, they raised something like $25 million and renovated this whole golf course. Grant Park today is YMCA, Kruger Stores, high school, but it was through an alliance of people, you know, rather than individualism that really made a difference. So those kind of corporate alliances in the inner city particularly you know, when you do feel isolated and not capable, can make such a really significant difference. Okay, this lady here.
And then I was just going to note, too, in response to that, that if the Koch brothers and all those, you know, top 1% were controlling everything, I don't think Barack Obama would have ever been elected. And so he's a sign that there, you know, that was a combination of some, you know, support from upper echelons, but also lots of support from the grassroots and, you know, lower level alliances.
Okay, this lady in here, you?
Also, the importance of conversation among white Americans about our own racism, our own beliefs that are so inherent in what, how we view the world in white and black terms, whether we want to do that or not. But by having that conversation and understanding, think of term as kind of decolonization, then we can carry that into our larger community and it becomes an antidote to the manipulation by political powers. And an open up conversation with non-white members of our society.
And there's also something about those in leadership being very transparent. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago and doing this thing on the BBC, on the radio, and just very openly saying, you know, I'm a recovering sectarian bigot.
Yes.
Now, the people that the people that criticized me for that were right-wing religious fundamentalists. They slaughtered me. In fact, there's two websites it was mentioned on, slaughtered me for daring to say that. The people that supported me were like political journalists. So that's a great, great thing. Glad you said that, Gary. Opens up a conversation that we all need to be part of. But this other lunatic on the right described me, typical social gospeler who doesn't really believe in Jesus. You know, like just to try to just rubbish you off completely in relation to that. No meaningful conversation, you know. But there's something about people actually standing up and saying that in a sense, and taking, you know, taking risks, you know. And I mean, I often look at Bill Clinton there, and you know, he had his foibles, as we all know, but Clinton took some brilliant risks for peace in Northern Ireland. In the early days, to be honest, I mean, Clinton could have wrecked his career. He didn't listen to his Secretary of State, nor to the State Department, and some of the strategic risks he took for peace in Northern Ireland. But you know what? It worked. You know? And despite some of the things people remember him for, that was a brilliant strategy around out there. So look, folks, tomorrow, sort of like, this is like part one, part two, we're going to sort of look more, you know, drill a little bit deeper into the memory. What should it be like to be a critical friend of those who pursue terrorism? So trying to give some examples, because that's what sort of terrorists call me as a person, a critical friend, who's tried to get into that mindset and understand that. Also look at some theology around this tomorrow, and sort of broaden it out a little to some of the, what are the roots of terrorism? Why do people make these choices? And historically, are there some remedies for dealing with memory? So that's tomorrow, okay?